This is 69 the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 69 has been covering the digital signage industry for more than 11 years now, first online and now as a podcast. We cover what's new and interesting, and we filter out all the BS. This podcast gives listeners a chance to hear at length from people and companies who are making a real mark in the industry with new ideas or just old-fashioned hard work and smarts. You can listen to episodes online, get it from iTunes or Google Play, or use your favorite podcast app to pull down the RSS feed. We now have a companion podcast called Projects, hosted by my longtime industry friend Michael Tutton. That show is all about digging deep on the creative and tech behind some landmark projects. 69 is sponsored and supported by ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. I had a great chat recently with Suzy Oparia-Bedia, the CEO and founder of Woven Media. Her company does all the heavy lifting work to connect digital signage and place-based networks with video from major content producers like TV networks, movie studios, and pro sports. If you're at a big U.S. retailer or in a healthcare environment that has screens, there's a decent chance at least some of the material you're seeing was aggregated, rights cleared, QA'd, and then distributed by her now 7-year-old San Francisco company. We get into a lot of things in this episode, from how the service got started and how it works for network operators, to what kind of material works with audiences and what doesn't. So Suzy, thanks for joining me. Can you tell me a little bit about what Woven Media is all about?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you very much, Dave, for having me on this podcast. It's a real pleasure to chat to you today. So Woven Media is, we've been around since 2010. We launched our product in 2011. And essentially what we are is we're a cloud video service that is combined of two main things. One is that we aggregate content. So we have a content aggregation business that's a standalone business, but is also tied to our technology stack. So we have a content management and delivery system that also includes content. So what we offer is we offer the ability for our customers to get access to great content if they already have the third-party systems in place. And we also allow for our customers to manage their networks with access to our content for, you know, essentially video networks in the industry.
And could you explain what you mean by aggregating content?
Yes, absolutely. So, and this is basically, you know, I think something that's quite unique for Woven Media, but, and this comes from the learnings of the team working in different companies in the industry in the past. And, you know, one of the things that's really critical for video networks, and I'm talking about networks that are in dwell, what we call dwell environments. So sure. Where you have consumers, you know, browsing merchandise or waiting for service, et cetera. So TV walls and electronics is an example. Mm-hmm. And those networks are very hungry for video that you would see on TV, you know, video from the broadcasters, sports leagues, movie trailers, that type of stuff. So what we do, and it's a practice that we've, you know, essentially built up from the beginning of the company, is we have relationships with over 130 premium providers, like, you know, all the major broadcasters here, Fox, NBC, ABC, et cetera, sports leagues and so on. And we get content from those folks. We put it into our system. And then we make it available for our subscribers to use that content on their network. So what you'll see is that, you know, if you were to walk into a Sam's Club, for example, you'll see a mix of Sam's Club programming, advertising, and content that's licensed through Woven Media.
And are these finished pieces that you're receiving from all these content providers, or are you getting something like B-roll or you know, a 30-second or a 30-minute piece, and then you guys cut it down into something that's workable for a place-based network?
That's a really good question. So the answer is it's a combination. So depending on the provider, we'll sometimes get long-form content. You know, we, for example, get kids' cartoons sometimes that are, you know, 15, 20 minutes long. We get, you know, nature and travel content that's longer format. And then from the broadcasters, typically we get, you know, promotional material, TV tune-ins, CNET, for example, you know, tech tips, that kind of stuff. So it really varies depending on who's providing the content. In terms of the work that we do, it's really very little. I mean, we you know, sometimes have to top and tail the video, you know, to get rid of the opening and the close. But for the most part, we use the video as is. Mm-hmm. In some cases, if it's longer form video, we chop it down a little bit. But really, the kind of, I think, the magic in the way the system works is that, or the way the ecosystem works, I should say, is that, you know, the content partners that we have see our distribution as highly valuable, obviously, because it has media value. Mm-hmm. And so as we grow our distribution and as we grow into different verticals, every time we add a new vertical, we're able to introduce new partners who see that vertical as, you know, very attractive in terms of the audience.
And are you getting the metrics from the various networks, the PlaySpace or signage networks that you provide content to, so that let's say it's a specialty channel that's looking for as many eyeballs as it can get and report back to its advertisers?
That's a really great question. And it's funny, we were having a call with our development team yesterday specifically about, you know, taking our reporting to the next level. But yes, essentially, we have to provide our content partners with viewership metrics. And we have to do it at a fairly granular level in the same way that you would do with an ad-based network if you had advertisers. And, you know, I think there's definitely some room for improvement in terms of the quality of reporting that we get back based on whatever CMS is being used. You know, if it's our CMS, you know, we have a very rich toolkit for proof of play reporting, and other CMSs do as well. But, you know, it varies from the reports we get back vary from, you know, a manual spreadsheet to a very detailed proof of play report from, you know, a sophisticated CMS.
Is the content that you're getting in better shape, better edited, more suitable to the environment now than when you started? Because I'm thinking, you know, you mentioned CNET. Companies like that now produce, you know, 1 minute, 90 second, 2 minute pieces specifically mm-hmm. for online, for quick mm-hmm. consumption on a mobile phone or a desktop and so on. Those would seem to be a mm-hmm. lot better than what you might have got 6 years ago, which was a TV channel sending you, here's 55 minutes, fill your boots.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that you're absolutely right. And I think that's just a sign of how the industry has evolved. I mean, you know, when we talk to the folks in marketing and promotions at the various media companies or, you know, whatever they may be, sports leagues, etc., they see digital at home as having a lot more value than it did, you know, perhaps 6 years ago. And I think that's because there's a lot more distribution and the quality of the experience has improved. So, you know, the value of the audience has gone up, but also they are able to get the metrics that, you know, perhaps they didn't get before. And so it's kind of this very nice virtuous cycle. The more content gets used, the more folks appreciate the value of providing that content. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's gotten to the point where we actually have some of our partners producing special one-off series, if you will, for particular, like the tennis channel, for example. They do during some of the key tournaments, they do, you know, daily tune-ins for us, customized for one of our larger clients. So it's really exciting to see how, you know, the content industry, shall I say, is moving with the evolution of you know, the industry in total.
Mm-hmm. How do the economics work? Are you buying content or are you acquiring content and reselling it and sharing a portion of the revenue back with the content producer?
So typically it's you can think of it as a bartered exchange. So for the most part, we don't pay for the content. Mm-hmm. And that's because, you know, the content provider sees value in the you know, the airtime that they get right. on right. networks. And then from our perspective, our model is a subscription-based model. it's not unlike the model for a CMS. You know, we charge monthly fees per screen or per media player, depending on the type of network. And it works very well, you know, and as long as we can continue to provide, you know, the types of audiences that these content providers are seeking outside the home, and we can show that we're providing these audiences in a quality environment where there's, you know, a high level of engagement, then I think, you know, we'll continue to just see continued growth on the content side of our business. The other thing I'd add that's really, I think, what's been key for our success in on the aggregation side is that we've built out a very robust platform with some very, you know, a bunch of tools that make it very seamless in terms of, you know, video ingest all the way through to video distribution. And we just launched a new version of our content product. But what I mean by that specifically is, you know, I've been in video tech pretty much my whole career. And as you know, video is big, it's clunky, it's heavy, it's hard, it's, you know, it there's a lot of bits. It's particularly when you're moving to, as we are, you know, moving to 4K and you know, eventually we'll get to 8K and so forth. But, you know, that you just get more and more bits that you have to manage from one end to the other. And so from the very beginning, when we conceived of this platform, we decided that we had to be very efficient about how we essentially manage video and how we deal with the movement of video from one end to the other. So we do all of our compression in the cloud, for example. We generate multiple versions of a particular clip for different network constraints, you know, so we'll do a higher bit rate for a network that can support that. Maybe it's a TV wall that needs higher quality video. We'll generate another version that's lower bit rate for networks that, you know, don't want to use up too much bandwidth, perhaps in healthcare. And then we also generate streaming versions of the content. So part of our offering allows for online video streaming as well. So we have that capability built in. And so the point there is that the easier we make it for the content providers to give us content and to see that that content gets to the endpoint, the easier it is for them to give us more content, because obviously they have to apply resources to the, you know, the whole process.
Right. So I have a kid in the insurance industry, and it strikes me as a kind of a simplified way to explain this is you're a bit like an insurance broker in that, yes, you could go directly to an insurance company and get insurance from them and deal with all that, but it gets very complicated and you're dealing with a bunch of different companies to find the best price and so on. What you're doing is aggregating all this stuff and making it very simple for both the content producer and the content consumer, so to speak, to get this stuff. They could probably do it on their own, but it would be enormously complicated in every which way.
That's absolutely right. And you know, you really nailed it there, Dave. And I think that's kind of, if I was to think about what our barrier is on the content side, it is exactly that. It's the toolkit that we have in place that makes it very easy to get the content and allow it to be consumed. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, it's the viewership. So, you know, right now we're reaching, you know, close to 120 million viewers a month. And so if you, as a digital out-of-home network or a retailer or, you know, an auto dealership or whatever, if you decided to go to ABC and say, hey, I want to have a relationship with you, I want to license your content for my network, the first hurdle you're going to hit is, well, you don't have the viewership that's of any interest to me. So we aggregate the content, but we're also aggregating the networks. And so that you know, just makes it more and more. Again, it's just the more distribution, the more partners, the more distribution. So it's a very nice virtuous cycle.
And somebody trying to do this on their own is going to be exactly where you were in 2010.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we and, you know, I founded the company, I worked for several years at PRN, and I run the product team there. And PRN at the time obviously were the leaders in yeah. particular vertical. And what I saw there was, you know, they had, you know, a building full of people doing the kind of stuff that we're doing now, which is establishing relationships with content companies, manually processing that video, making it available in a very manual, you know, process heavy fashion. And so, you know, we actually, some key members on our team also came from PRN, and you know, one of the things we learned was this is absolutely not scalable. I mean, if you, it's great if you have an army full of people who you can pay to, you know, program your network and put content on it that's third party content and so on. But how do you package that all up and put it in a neat little box so that, you know, a marketing person in the healthcare space can program screens in 30 clinics without having to have agreements with ABC, NBC, et cetera, have a video team that can encode that video, and literally how can one person program an entire network with everything they need to do that, you know, as cost effectively as possible, delivering a quality experience.
It takes time and real money to make and host this podcast, so I'm grateful for the continuing support of ScreenFeed.
Hi, this is Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. I hope you're enjoying the podcast as much as I am. I've loved Dave's blog since we started in the industry. It's now our 10th year at ScreenFeed, and we've grown to be a reliable partner for the industry, serving over 1,700 customers with over 100,000 screens globally, and we're currently getting 10 million content requests daily. But more important than that is that we make content beautiful, functional for the medium, and we help our customers meet their goals of increasing viewership and satisfying customers. If you don't know how ScreenFeed can help you, it's worth 5 minutes to you browse our website or give us a call. If you're out walking your dog, driving home, or relaxing on your favorite chair, just make a mental note to check us out. Now back to the podcast.
So in certain respects, you kind of filled a bit of a vacuum that maybe was created through the changes with PRN?
Well, I think, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily. I mean, yeah, that's probably perhaps a one way of describing it. The way I would probably describe it a little differently is I think of PRN, at least certainly when I left the company, as more of an agency, if you will, with a tech arm. And so, you know, as an agency, you know, it's very high touch. There's, you know, I mean, you understand. I see us more as a technology company with a strong content offering. So we don't have to have that very high touch relationship. We're offering a service that allows anyone from Sam's Club to, you know, our client Ultima, the clinic group, to program their network with one or two people and not have to engage us much other than letting us know how they want us to improve the toolkit or how they want us to, you know, evolve the content that we provide.
But a company like Sam's Club was using PRN way back when, were they not? And they needed somebody to produce that content.
That's exactly right. So the approach with Sam's Club, who, you know, was PRN's client a while back, was PRN were essentially programming the network for them. So PRN would go out and they would get the content and they would obviously sell the advertising and they'd get the content that the retailer programming from Sam's Club and they'd do all the work for them. And, you know, I think the challenge with that is, or the opportunity, I should say, is that Sam's Club didn't have any of the control, right? So, I mean, you've got somebody who is doing this work for you who has obviously a huge incentive to make money from the advertising that they're selling on the network and perhaps less of an incentive to serve the strategic interests of the company.
Yeah.
So, you know, our vision is turn that completely on its head. We're not an ad sales business. We have no interest in the ad revenue other than that we want there to be, you know, that there has to be, the P&L has to work for Sam's Club or whoever else is investing in this type of thing. But give Sam's Club, give the business the control, give them everything they need to do the job themselves. And they, you know, then have control, complete strategic control of the messaging and what they want on the network, et cetera.
Right. Well, how do you deal with audio? That's a massive problem in the digital signage industry, because so many networks are silent. And when they try to use audio, it makes the staff insane.
That's a really good question. So, you know, our focus is dwell networks where you have a longer viewing experience typically. And so we're not into menu boards or, you know, end cap displays or that kind of stuff. We could do that, but that's not where we're focusing. And, you know, we do have some guidelines or some, you know, advice, if you will, that we give our clients in terms of the strategy for programming. So, you know, great, you know that somebody's hanging out in your space for 30 minutes. So you have perhaps an hour long loop, and you know you have a certain frequency, and if you have ads on there, so that it's not too repetitive. So I think it's easy to do that, to create that experience that's not repetitive, not irritating, not annoying for the consumer or the audience who are coming into your place maybe once a week at most, maybe once every couple of weeks, maybe longer. For the people that are in there, that you know, the associates, the folks that are working in the healthcare clinic lobby or whatever, we advise that you change the programming up frequently. You know, you use tools like day parting and week parts and so on. So you use, you know, the tricks of scheduling so that you know, randomization, et cetera, so that you can mix the content up so you don't get that repetitive
right.
irritation.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to people like me who've been around this space for a long time and see certain types of content on networks that appears to be there for no reason other than they want to, the operator wants to pad the programming loop. Mm-hmm. You know, they need stuff to keep it fresh. And
mm-hmm.
I, you know, I've been in no end of retail environments where I've seen adventure surfing, adventure skiing, and music videos and all kinds of things. And I'm looking at these screens and wondering, why is this on here? And
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What was the point? Like, how do you respond to, you know, people like me, but also how do you coach your end users to say, you know, try to find the stuff that really matches your audience, matches the emotion, matches the dynamics
yes.
of what's going on?
Yes, yeah, that's a really great question. And I think, you know, a lot of the folks that license our content are network aggregators themselves. So, you know, folks that are aggregating networks in auto or healthcare or retail or cute, you know, quick serve restaurants.
Right.
And what we're seeing is that they give us a lot of feedback, and they seem to be doing more and more testing in terms of what works and what doesn't work with their audiences. And I think that if the network operator or whoever's programming the network has a very clear understanding of their audience, then they do a pretty good job of tailoring the content to their audience. And I'll give you a really good example. We have, I keep referencing our client at this clinic group, but that's because they were our first client and they use our full stack, including our CMS. Mm-hmm. But they have, you know, clinics in, you know, so they have women's health, they have pediatrics, they have, you know, seniors. So they have different clinic groups. And I think they do a really spectacular job of selecting the content from our library that's most relevant for the audience. So if pediatrics throw on a lot of kids' cartoons, if it's a Hispanic audience, which just happens to be, put some Spanish language programming on there, etc. So I agree with you. I think there's still more work to be done in terms of optimizing the content to suit the audience. But what we're seeing is that there seems to be, at least from our perspective, there seems to be more information being delivered to these folks. And in some cases, you know, Nielsen studies are being done. You know, one of our clients did a Nielsen study where they looked at, you know, which you know, men, women, you know, what did they like to watch more? What content did they resonate with the most? And then sort of tailored the programming to suit that audience. Mm-hmm. The one thing I will say, though, about particularly the TVs that you see in the electronics department at retail is that the primary function of the content on those TVs is to sell those TVs.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what's most important is that you show people content that resonates with what they might see at home or that highlights the quality of the set, etc. Mm-hmm. We've started providing 4K content. We just recently deployed a 4K, complete 4K solution at one of our clients. And that's another example where it's less about what the content is, and it's more about how do you, particularly in a TV merchandising application, how do you highlight the difference between a 4K set and an HD set so the consumer is drawn to the 4K set. And, you know, then so you'll typically see type of stuff you mentioned, like extreme sports, you know, travel content, wildlife, etc., because that content just happens to really make the pop the differentiation.
So I might finally at least at trade shows start seeing 4K content other than those. There's that one company that has their cinemagraphs or almost like high-end animated GIFs that just show nature scenes.
Yes, yes. No, absolutely. And in fact, when we were at DSC earlier this year, we were showcasing our 4K content, and we have more and more of us, our subscribers, predominantly, I'd say, in retail and predominantly, you know, like I said, the TV wall application, because that's where the sets are. But definitely we're getting, you know, we've been growing our 4K library for the last 2 years in anticipation of, you know, where the industry is going, and it's paid off for us.
Is there almost like a top five? Is there particular types of content that seem to sell a lot more than others?
Yes, definitely. Entertainment is always very appealing to folks. And by entertainment, that could be anything from, you know, snippets from TV shows to movie trailers, that kind of stuff, daytime TV. You know, some of the food shows are extremely popular, like ABC's The Chew, for example. Mm-hmm. So entertainment is definitely a category that's extremely popular. Sports, obviously, that goes without saying, you know. And then health and wellness seems to be a category that's increasingly popular for certain verticals. Tech is always, you know, interesting. So yeah, those are, and then I would also say that bilingual, so we aggregate a lot of Spanish language programming as well, and that's particularly popular if, you uh-huh. know, the audience skews Hispanic.
Right. On the flip side, have you learned over the years that there's stuff that just doesn't work or nobody wants?
Well, interestingly, yeah. I mean, I would say the longer form content is not particularly popular. So, and that's just because it just doesn't work. You know, you throw up a 20-minute long form, whatever it is, and it doesn't work with a model, you know. So I would say certainly that. And I think, you know, I think that we've found that because we've grown the content as we've grown our distribution, it's worked pretty well in that the content that we provide is consumed, you know. So we don't go establishing relationships with folks until we know that there's a prospective audience, you know.
Right.
I will say that the video quality is really important. So, you know, as we move, obviously now we're all fully HD, but if the video quality is not high enough that's provided to us, that's not, you know, that gets rejected.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the company. You're based in San Francisco.
Yes.
Could you have not found a more expensive place for staffing and real estate?
Yes, great question. Yeah, so the reason we're based in San Francisco is because I live here. So that's one convenience. And I moved to San Francisco in 95. I moved from England, and I've worked predominantly for tech companies. I worked for a while in Silicon Valley, and then I worked for PRN and Citi. And so, you know, when we founded the company, obviously we didn't have a nice office in San Francisco around the corner from the ballpark. We started from much more humble beginnings. But, you know, I think what's been really great for us in terms of, you know, how we've approached growing the company is that the approach has always been, how do you scale as efficiently as possible? So, you know, build the tech so that you don't have to have too many people and doing things that tech can do. And we have an offshore development team in Armenia who are incredible. I mean, they're an amazingly talented group of men and women who, that's our core development team. But that's obviously saved us a tremendous amount. So we're not actually, we don't hire Silicon Valley engineers here in our office in San Francisco. And then, you know, we just, you know, we got a really good lease agreement with our sub-landlord, and we've just been extremely lucky in getting the space that we have, and you know, we've got a new lease, and I hope that continues. But certainly, if I was going to be looking for office space here today, we absolutely couldn't afford it. It's just it's
insane,
as you're suggesting, outrageous.
How big overall is the company now in terms of staff?
So we have a total of 15 folks. We've got as I mentioned, we've got the offshore team and the team here. And then we do a lot of stuff at a house. So, you know, back office,
sure.
All the hosting
and everybody.
Support. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So amazingly enough, running out of time already. Could you kind of give me an idea of what's going on with your company and where you see the industry over the next year and a half?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think what we're seeing is some interesting opportunities, larger opportunities in certain verticals like retail, for example, where there are systems that have been in place for a while, and we're coming into kind of a new generation of technologies with new compression formats, 4K video, new sets, etc. And so I think there's going to be an opportunity for, you know, quite a few resets in some of those companies that have had systems in there for a while and want to just move forward with the next wave of technology. And then certainly what's really been interesting for me to observe is the way the aggregation model is evolving. So I think that we're just going to see more and more of that. And not a lot of people talk about this, but, you know, I think it's fascinating when you see folks aggregating networks in auto, for example, whether it's dealerships or service. And what we're seeing is that, you know, because we bill on a per location or whatever basis, we're seeing just organic growth as those networks grow. And I mean, that to me is proof that the industry is growing. I mean, that there are more and more screens out there. There are more and more aggregators who are managing those screens. And there's more and more perceived value from the business, as it were, you know, to have those screens in their location. So I think that growth that we're seeing is going to be very, very interesting to watch. And I think it's going to be the engine that drives the industry. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to have businesses have to have a rationale for having TVs in their, you know, on their premises. And that experience has to be a good experience. And so I think it's all very positive in terms of growth across, you know, all the segments that, you know, you would typically talk about.
All right. Susie, a pleasure to chat with you.
Great talking to you as well, Dave. And thanks again for the opportunity.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening and learned something. If you want to stay on top of what's happening and actually matters in digital signage, join thousands of readers who visit 16.9, that's 16-9.net every day. If you like this podcast, please also check out the companion 69 podcast called Projects. That's done by Michael Tutton, and there's a new episode every second Friday. 69 the blog and now the podcast are properties of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare bedroom in my house near Toronto. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, ScreenFeed, and thank you for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.